Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Let's rewind to yesterday when we told you the Chinese government was hiking the country's gas and diesel prices by 18%. Here's what we reported 24 hours ago. Analysts say the move could cause a significant drop in demand from the world's second largest oil user. World oil prices dropped as much as $3 a barrel today. Yeah, stop the tape and never mind all that. Seems there's a new rule when it comes to oil prices. There are no rules. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity, online at us.areva.com. And by Clarkson Potters, the splendid table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. We've finally made it to the weekend. It's Friday, the 20th of June, and we're glad you could join us. Another day, another gyration in oil prices. They're back up to around $134 a barrel after falling yesterday on news of that big jump in Chinese gasoline prices. Beijing lifted some subsidies on domestic fuel, allowing prices to get closer to market rates. The theory had been that such a move would cut demand in China and allow global prices to ease off. But as Jeremy Hobson reports, we should all know by now what happens when we start assuming anything about oil prices these days.
China has the world's fastest growth in oil demand, and bumping up the price of fuel was supposed to be a good faith effort aimed at denting that demand, right before this weekend's meeting of the big oil players in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. But Phil Flynn, a senior market analyst at Aileron Trading in Chicago, isn't convinced it worked.
Some people are not sure that this increase in price in China is going to be enough to curtail demand. In fact, some people believe that it will actually increase demand.
And even if it does curtail demand, says Rushir Kadakia with Cambridge Energy Research Associates, we won't know it for some time. And that's why traders are moving on.
Trends in supply and demand take much, much longer to flow through the market simply because consumer behavior doesn't change overnight. But geopolitical shocks, events that are happening in Nigeria or the Middle East, those geopolitical impacts are going to be much more volatile and have much more significance in the market.
He says that's because the global supply-demand balance is so tight on a daily basis, there's very little wiggle room. Today, for instance, oil prices were driven up by news that a military exercise Israel conducted earlier this month could have been a test run for an attack on Iran. As Phil Flynn on the trading floor in Chicago puts it,
this market is living headline to headline, and they're doing that because they're worried about this tight spare production capacity in the world.
And Flynn says in the end, it comes down to a general worry in the market. No one really knows how much oil is left. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Talk to hog farmers in southeast Iowa about their business lately, and a litany of words springs from their lips, such as catastrophe, decimated, and utterly horrible. Now, you might think that it's the floods that have hurt them, but Marketplace's Steve Henn reports it's something else. High feed prices that threaten to drive more than 7,000 hog farmers out of business by the end of the year.
Brandon Butler's a hog farmer in southeast Iowa. He's watched neighbors lose all their crops and livestock, bridges wash away, and fields flood.
This is catastrophic. There's no other way to describe it.
Butler's farm sits high and was spared, but he and livestock producers are going to feel the effects of this flood. Corn and feed prices have more than tripled since 2005 and shot up again this week. Chris Hertz, an agricultural economist at Purdue, he says what's really hurting hog farmers isn't just the flood, it's high fuel prices.
Biofuels are dramatically helping to increase the price of corn.
So much so that a consortium of meat producers are criticizing ethanol mandates on Capitol Hill. Dave Warner's at the Pork Producers Council.
We are not on a level playing field when it comes to competing for corn against ethanol plants.
Warner's worried there might not be enough corn this year for both feed and renewable fuels. The rising price of oil is pushing up what ethanol plants are willing to pay for corn. And federal law requires oil companies to buy billions of gallons of ethanol each year, no matter what the price, to make blended fuels. Livestock farmers can't compete, and thousands could be forced out of business. Hertz says that means shoppers are in for sticker shock in the meat aisle starting soon.
And I think we'll see new high records as far as we can see, probably through 2012. Each year, higher and higher and higher prices.
In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
And indeed, on to the meat of the story. You might have heard about massive protests in South Korea over American beef. Many South Koreans fear U.S. beef isn't safe after a breakout of mad cow disease back in 2003 halted exports. While the crisis may be coming to an end, South Korea's president replaced 9 of 10 senior cabinet officials today and apologized on national TV for mishandling the issue. At the same time, trade negotiators meeting in Washington were closing in on a new U.S. beef deal. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
In 2003, South Korea was the third largest export market for U.S. beef, but a mad cow breakout shut down exports. This April, South Korea said it would finally lift the ban. That prospect had U.S. beef producers salivating. Then a firestorm of protests in South Korea tabled the issue. Jeremy Russell's with the National Meat Association.
It's an important market because Korea right now has the highest prices for beef in the world. So it's a market where we could actually sell some product if it were open.
The U.S. and South Korea may be close to a deal that would allow imports of U.S. beef that's younger than 30 months old. Many South Koreans believe that younger cattle are less likely to have mad cow disease. Jim Herlihy is with the U.S. Meat Export Federation.
So we're looking to find a point where we can reach agreement and to help reestablish trade.
But these protests are more than a beef with U.S. beef. It's dissatisfaction with the new president and a growing protectionist sentiment. Donald Gregg is former U.S. ambassador to South Korea. He says most South Koreans are descendants of farmers.
They have this sentimental image of what life on the farm is like, and they do not like the idea of the crashing into Korea of foreign imports that will devastate the traditional way that grandpa and grandma have made their living for generations.
Despite the protests, the South Korean government still plans to implement new U.S. beef standards next week. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Well, they banished almost all the bulls from Wall Street today. We'll tell you about that 220-point downhill stampede for the Dow when we check with Mr. Johnson and when we do the numbers. Have you noticed there's a hot new investment out there? A decade ago, it was telecom and internet companies. 5 years ago, it was commercial and residential real estate. This year, it's public infrastructure that's drawing the big money. Yes, we mean socking your money away in bridges, tunnels, and roads. They may look solid and boring, but in these volatile, troubled times, solid and boring is in, especially when it generates a decent return. As Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports, states and cities around the country are happy to sell, even to foreign firms.
The Pennsylvania Turnpike is one of the oldest highways in the nation. It costs a lot to maintain. Last month, the governor put the entire toll road, all 500 miles of it, on the market.
And the Pennsylvania Turnpike will make it a nice ride for you.
A Spanish road operator called Abertis, with a little help from Citigroup, offered the most. $5 billion in repair work, plus a pile of cash, $12.8 billion.
And that will allow us to do thousands of bridge repairs and hundreds of miles of road construction and billions of dollars into public transit over a very long period.
Roy Kienitz is deputy chief of staff for Governor Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania. Rendell's a Democrat, but Kienitz says he's turning to the private sector because public funding's hard to come by.
The problem is the traditional way that roads and bridges have been funded in the United States has been through the gasoline tax. And in the current environment, it's just impossible to raise the gasoline tax. It is never going to happen.
If the deal goes through, Pennsylvania will rent out the turnpike for 75 years. In exchange for maintaining the road, Abertis gets to collect and keep all the tolls. At the end, the highway reverts back to the state. Not everyone likes the idea. Unions worry about toll collectors and repair jobs. Drivers fret about toll hikes. Some citizens don't like putting America's landmarks into foreign hands. Dennis Enright of the NW Financial Group analyzes privatization deals. He says they don't make economic sense. He says cities and states could get the upfront cash they need on the tax-exempt bond market.
They could get 30% more money or have 30% lower user fees by doing it with public financing rather than private.
But local governments aren't convinced. They're inspired by the deal Chicago made in 2005. It leased the Skyway toll road for $1.8 billion, and Indiana leased its turnpike for $3.8
billion. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been cleared for departure.
It's not just roads. Chicago hopes someone will pay to lease its Midway airport later this year. It might have some luck on Wall Street. Investors are pouring money into infrastructure funds run by Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Credit Suisse. One of the biggest private equity firms, the Carlyle Group, recently raised $1.2 billion. Robert Dove is co-head of the fund. He loves infrastructure, especially now that the market is so volatile.
It's not got operational risk. It's not got technology risk. It's not got build-out risk. These are assets which are stable, proven, predictable, public benefit, essential service assets.
Dove tells investors to expect returns above 10%, much higher than corporate bonds. More than $30 billion of Wall Street money is aimed at infrastructure. That wave of cash is putting pressure on politicians and public officials to hand the keys over to the private sector. But Wall Street might get a shock when it finds out how long it takes to get an infrastructure deal done. In Pennsylvania, the governor is still waiting for the state legislature to approve his highway sale. I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson in Dallas. And there, David, it's going to be okay.
You know, it's just what I needed, a little pat on the back, maybe a little chocolate cream or something like that.
Well, lie back on the couch and tell me, what happened?
You know, what it is, Bob, it's like I wake up every morning and I hear, "I Got You, Babe," on the clock radio. It's like that movie that just won't go away, the Groundhog Day. It's just the same stuff.
So what spooked you guys today?
Well, I think it was financials. It's easy to say oil, and we had this nice little ribbon tied around oil yesterday with a story out of China that they're going to jack up prices on gasoline and distillates, and so that helped out a lot. But today it was this drumbeat's been going on in the financials here for the last couple of days. Some regional banks had some trouble. This bank with this unlikely name, Fifth Third Bank, is going to have to raise money, and they cut their dividend. And that was kind of put aside. But then the major money center banks started saying, we're probably going to have to do some write-offs. Well, we've been there.
Well, we know all that. We know all that's going to be happening, right?
Well, that's what I thought. And I thought it was over with. You take enormous write-offs, you'd say, well, look, you threw the kitchen sink in there. What is left? Are you going to rip out the floors and write that off? So that keeps going on.
Well, this was an unusual day also, right? We had a kind of a settling of the books today, too.
Yeah, well, this is this quarterly phenomenon. It used to be the triple witch, but I think because of the inflation in the economy, it's now the quadruple witching day. It's options and indexes and futures, and probably if I understood it, I wouldn't have time to explain it. But the net result is you get a lot of volatility, and you get a lot of volume. And Fridays, now this is not a good sign, Bob, but I mean Fridays we have been going down in general. You know, there's a reluctance to want to hold stocks over the weekend. So these traders who can tend to dump stocks. So you have this option expiration day come along, and it happens to be Friday, and they dump stocks.
And so when are things going to settle down?
I don't know. I thought maybe oil would be the answer. I still kind of think that that oil has peaked. I guess that's a different use of the term, but that maybe we've got that behind us. But, you know, I'm back to this Groundhog Day thing. We just keep coming back to the financials that are writing off and the rumors that there are going to be more write-offs. And then just when you think everything's hunky-dory and you wake up in the morning and everything's fine, you open the paper and you find out that some, cool group like the Royal Bank of Scotland has written a report that says we need to brace for a full-fledged crash of the global stock and credit markets.
Mm-hmm. I thought your first answer was more profound, David. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I've found that honesty can be very disarming.
Thank you,
especially
David.
Coming from a stockbroker.
David Johnson in Dallas. Coming up, a bright side to those high gas prices.
When average prices rise, then typically wages also rise. It might be a few months later, but our spending power typically remains unchanged.
But first, let's do the numbers. So here's the damage today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average staggered 1.8%, or 220 points, to close at 11,842. The NASDAQ plunged 2.25%, or 55 points, to close at 2406. The S&P 500 slid 1.8%, or 24 points, to end the day at 1317. For the week, the Dow tumbled 3.8%. The NASDAQ moved down 2%. The S&P 500 fell 3.1%. More of that discouraging financial news David was just referring to. Lehman Brothers said it expects federally backed mortgage lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to sustain greater losses in the second quarter. Shares of Freddie Mac suffered a 7.75% loss. Fannie Mae faltered 4.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Marketplace entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday, June 23rd. In Washington, a House committee holds a hearing titled Energy Speculation. Is greater regulation necessary to stop price manipulation? The International Whaling Commission's 60th annual meeting begins in Santiago, Chile. And Oscar-winning actress Frances McDormand celebrates her birthday. She'll be 51. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. The Mississippi is a river of broken dreams and broken hearts today as a devastating flood crest rolls downstream. The roiling waters have breached dozens of levees this week, swamping scores of towns along the way and washing over some of the region's most fertile farm fields, causing billions of dollars in damage. And it could take months for the water to recede. Today, a new government study is predicting that floods, droughts, and severe storms are likely to ravage North America more often. The study by the Climate Change Science Program blames emissions of planet-warming gases. Which raises the question, is the insurance industry able to deal with all this? For some answers, we turn to Professor Robert Hoyt, an expert in risk management at the University of Georgia. Appreciate you joining us.
My pleasure.
We keep hearing that this is the quote-unquote 100-year flood. But it seems like a lot of these natural disasters, floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, that they're happening a lot more frequently. Has the risk model adapted, or does it still need to be reevaluated as these things continue to happen?
Well, I think the jury is still out on whether or not there's really been a significant shift in the frequency. There's actually been a recent report from NOAA that suggests that there may be some evidence. But the one thing that I think we can say with confidence is that the society in our country, and certainly in many other countries, has expanded the exposure in these catastrophe-prone areas by development on coastal exposed areas, by development in riparian flood regions, and so forth. So all we'd have to do is look back to Iowa 150 years ago to know that the exposure wouldn't be anywhere near what it is today.
Is the insurance industry changing the way it does business in any way to account for that?
Well, I think it's important to realize that Hurricane Andrew, which occurred in 1992, by and large, I think, represented a wake-up call to the insurance industry with regards to the extent to which the industry had exposure in isolated geographic areas. in the aftermath of that event in 1992, a number of risk modeling firms came into existence. As a result of that, the industry has been pretty aggressive at reviewing and understanding what this so-called accumulation of risk, the amount of exposure that they would face in any one single disaster, what that looks like.
In some cases, pulling out of these markets or maybe adjusting deductibles, that sort of thing?
There certainly have been cases of that sort. It certainly has meant that they have reduced the amount of policies that they would sell within a particular region. But there certainly have been other cases where the industry has identified areas where they felt that it was possible for them to take on additional risk. So I think overall, it's meant a better understanding of what the risk exposures are and, by and large, probably brought more coverage to the table.
Well, if it's true that more and more people are in harm's way, does the government need to take a more active role to make sure that people aren't in the direct path of these disasters?
Certainly. I think, I would say any time the government spends billions of dollars in the aftermath of disaster, there should be some right to be a party to the solutions going forward. And I think those solutions have to involve serious consideration of risk mitigation, that is, building buildings that can withstand natural disasters in a better way looking forward. And in some extreme cases, it may mean that building is done in new areas. Obviously, there's been some reports of communities that are even contemplating whether or not they should move their footprint to higher ground, so to speak. So I think that's the discussion that has to result. Obviously, in the current situation, right in the midst of the disaster, I think is not the right time to take those on wholeheartedly, but certainly it's very important that this discussion progress over the coming months.
Professor Robert Hoyt is an expert in risk management at the University of Georgia. Thanks for your insights.
My pleasure.
You may find this hard to believe, but the higher gasoline prices go, there's a good chance your corner station is almost giving it away. Consider this. They have to buy thousands of gallons of ever pricier product to keep their pumps full, and then they have to compete penny for penny with discount giants like Costco. But here's where their margins really get shaved. More expensive gas also means retailers are shelling out more in credit card fees. We sent Stacey Vanek Smith to an independent station to give us a fill on this.
My car is not fuel efficient, so the $4.70 it costs for a gallon of gas in Los Angeles has been hard. It's been hard for gas stations, too, like the Magic Gas and Cafe, which has no gas today.
Okay, well, all the pumps are out of order.
Actress Heidi Darchuk was trying to fill up, too.
Right now, I'm totally out of gas. I don't know if I'm even going to make it to the other gas station.
Expensive fuel means it can be hard for independent gas stations to afford to keep their pumps full. It also means they're paying more in credit card fees.
Retailers are losing money every time they sell a gallon of gas and you pay by credit card.
Jeff Leonard is with the National Association of Convenience Stores. He says gas stations make about 12 cents a gallon on gas. When a customer pays with plastic, about 10 cents of that goes to the card company.
As prices have risen, we've seen a dramatic increase in the use of plastic. So the hit is double with the rising prices.
But MasterCard says stores attract customers by taking their card. And it says its 2% fee hasn't gone up. Going cash only is pretty impossible these days, says the National Retail Federation's Mallory Duncan. He says card companies know this.
It's hard on everyone, but it's particularly hard on the independents. Independent gas station owners have actually made less than the credit card companies have off the sale of gasoline.
Last year, gas stations and convenience stores paid more than $7.5 billion in credit card fees, about double what their profits were. Those profits mostly come from the sale of food and drinks, like this Coke I went inside to buy.
Can I pay with my credit card?
Cash you can, then.
Okay, I've got cash.
Now, if I could just find some gas. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Are these rising gas prices a crisis, or are they really a blessing in disguise? We're seeing Americans driving fewer miles, 1.4 billion fewer highway miles in April than we did in April 2007, and buying smaller cars. Sales of midsize SUVs dropped 38% last month compared with May of last year. Economist Justin Wolfer says we're being compensated for these higher gas prices. We just don't realize it.
Gas at $4 a gallon is causing a lot of despair, but I'm not quite sure why. Let me explain. To an economist, a higher gas price is really two things. First, it's a shift in the relative price of gas versus other stuff. Second, it's also a rise in the average price level. Let's begin with a shift in relative prices. The fact that gas is more expensive relative to other stuff is what's called a relative price shift. Now, I can understand being upset that buying a gallon of gas now requires doing without more of this other stuff. But look on the bright side. Each gallon of gas you conserve now buys you more other stuff. Stated this way, it sounds like a much better deal. Of course, relative price shifts do create winners and losers. Political discussions always seem to focus on the noisy complaints of those who lose, such as the McMansion dweller whose increasingly expensive commute is undermining his home value. What's missing is the picture of the smiling urbanite who's earning a handsome return on her investment. Perhaps instead our despair reflects higher average prices. When average prices rise and incomes don't, then we have less spending power and we get less gas and less other stuff. But I have some good news. When average prices rise, then typically wages also rise. It might be a few months later, but our spending power typically remains unchanged. So why the concern? One explanation is simply that we fail to understand that wages rise in tandem with average prices. Behavioral economists tell us that when each of us gets our annual raise, we think that this is a reward for our hard work, rather than something as trivial as a cost of living adjustment. So each year, we think that our employer realizes we are ever more brilliant, even as rising gas prices steal more from our paycheck. The truth is more mundane. You aren't that brilliant, but you are going to be compensated for those higher gas prices.
Justin Wolfers is an associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, the latest in an expensive series of moves by the major airlines to wring more money from passengers' wallets. Now United Airlines says it's going to start requiring minimum stays for nearly all domestic flights. Otherwise, you'll pay a penalty. The new policy begins in October. It means you'll be required to stay at least 1 to 3 nights at your destination, or in some cases, a minimum weekend night stay. That's most likely to ding business travelers who like to catch a flight out in the morning and then make it back in time for dinner at night. Oh, yes, one more thing. United is raising its cheapest ticket prices by as much as $90 one way. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow heaved off 220 points, 1 8/10%. The Nasdaq fell 55 points, 2 1/4%. And the S&P 500 lost 22 points, 1 7/10%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up Monday, cracking down on multitasking motorists.
Everything from people eating, applying makeup, shaving, even having sex in the car while driving.
Hey, hands back on the steering wheel. I'm Bob Moon. We'll be back here Monday. Hope you will be too.
American Public Media.